This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade.
It looks like one of those scenes of an old building being purposely dynamited and blown.
When we are successful,
I'm just a patsy.
And we will be.
We're ready to make to come to the microphone, so we'll listen up.
A new world order.
So my name's Robbie Parker.
It might have appeared that way, but from my close-up inspection, there's no evidence of a plane having crashed anywhere near the Pentagon.
Let us never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories concerning the attacks of September the 11th.
President Kennedy died at 1 p.m.
Live from the Media Broadcasting Center.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, where for the first hour today, actually slightly less, I have an excellent video about 9/11 that covers aspects that I have not covered myself before, where although it has a couple of flaws, in particular, it talks about nanothermite as being the principal causal mechanism for destroying the Twin Towers, which T. Mark Hightower, a chemical engineer, and I have demonstrated to be impossible, because although nanothermite is emits brilliant light and intensely high temperatures, it lacks the rapid gas expansion properties that are characteristic of explosives and therefore cannot have brought down the Twin Towers. Though it may have been used, it couldn't have been responsible for blowing them. And in the second place, it talks about the planes as though they were bona fide real planes, which, of course, I would say at the time this was done may have been a matter where they were unfamiliar with the evidence. But where I like this video so much that I believe if you look at this in connection with our show number 100, where I interviewed Major General Albert Stubblebine, U.S. Army retired, formerly in charge of all U.S. military intelligence, about the faking of all four crash sites, and show number 103 with Dennis Camino about who was responsible and why. I think if you put the three together, you have a very comprehensive understanding of the events of 9/11. So I'll have a few words to add after the show. Meanwhile, sit back, enjoy what is really quite a remarkable, fascinating study about some of the more covert, more grotesque financial and other aspects of 9/11. Watch it now.
In September 1991, shortly after the end of the Cold War, a cabal of elite bankers and intelligence spooks led by George H.W. Bush financed a $240 billion covert operations war chest through the purchase of 10-year securities that, as it happened, were scheduled to come due on September 12, 2001. Project Hammer was undoubtedly used for a wide variety of illicit intelligence operations, but mainly it was used to finance a covert economic operation against the collapsing Soviet Union, whereby unknown Western investors bought up much of the Soviet industry with a focus on oil and gas, crashing the Russian economy, looting its central bank, orchestrating what became known as the Great Ruble Scam, and a wide variety of other clandestine, state-assisted operations designed to thoroughly prevent Russia from ever contesting the U.S. as a world superpower, while in the process lining the pockets of these economic hitmen who swooped in to devour the collapsing Russian economy after the fall of the Soviet Union. A spectacular investment for all, at least until money laundering investigations began tracing all the money, or when the 10-year deadline came up and the securities became due and began the routine process of authenticity and ownership checks. Evidence shows that several federal and private investigations had already stumbled upon the Hammer Fund and were compiling evidence on it up until the 9/11 attacks. These included the Office of Naval Intelligence, or ONI, which was moved to the outer E-ring of the recently renovated section of the Pentagon that was targeted and destroyed on 9/11. According to E.P. Heidner, the ONI had been investigating crimes associated with the plundering of Russia. 39 out of the 40 people who worked in those offices were killed on 9/11, including the entire chain of command. The Pentagon's financial accounting offices in that same wing were also an obvious target, as were the passengers on board Flight 77. many of whom coincidentally held top-secret clearances and were connected with Pentagon black operations. Agents of the Office of Naval Intelligence had also been investigating financial transactions which were linked to securities being managed by those securities dealers in the World Trade Center that were also targeted. 31% of the 125 fatalities in the Pentagon were from the Naval Command Center that housed the Office of Naval Intelligence. 41% of the fatalities in the Twin Towers came from two companies that managed U.S. government securities, Cantor Fitzgerald and Eurobrokers. There were three major security brokers in the World Trade Center, Cantor Fitzgerald, Eurobrokers, and Garbin Intercapital. At 8:46 on the morning of September 11th, Flight 11 flew directly into Martian McLennan's secure computer room in the North Tower, right below the floor on which Cantor Fitzgerald was situated. Cantor Fitzgerald was the largest security dealer in the U.S. Shortly after that, a massive explosion went off just under the FBI offices in the North Tower on the 23rd floor. Fires were reported on the 22nd floor at 8:47. There were also explosions and subsequent fires reported at Garbin Intercapital on the 25th floor and in the basement of Tower 1 as well. Shortly thereafter, at 9:03, Flight 175 hit the South Tower right below the floors on which Eurobrokers was situated. In all three cases, the explosive, fiery destruction consumed the offices in the several floors above, destroying files and trapping victims inside. In the midst of all this, Building 6 was destroyed by an explosion that took place before either tower fell. This secondary explosion took out a portion of the building which just happened to include the El Dorado Task Force's offices. The El Dorado Task Force was an interagency money laundering watchdog group responsible for coordinating all major money laundering investigations in the U.S. In the immediate aftermath of September 11th, these groups would be redirected to investigate terrorist financing. Building 6 was located directly between the North Tower and World Trade Center Building 7. While large portions of World Trade Center 6 were gutted by explosions and later by falling debris from the North Tower, the building itself did not suffer a global symmetric collapse at near freefall acceleration as did Buildings 1, 2, and 7. FEMA photographer and 9/11 whistleblower Kurt Sonnenfeld took some interesting pictures of the U.S. Customs vault in the basement of World Trade Center 6, which was found completely empty and left with the door wide open. All of its contents appear to have been looted during the attacks. There is also evidence that gold was being looted from the vaults beneath World Trade Center 4. There were several early reports of a 10-wheel truck packed with stolen bullion caught fleeing World Trade Center 5 when the vehicle had become stuck on a collapsed ceiling brace, forcing the driver to flee the scene. Many researchers have stumbled across one or two of these anomalies from time to time, the empty vaults, the secondary explosions, the fireproofing upgrades on the exact floors coinciding with failure and impact in the towers, the suspicious power downs and evacuation drills, the World Trade Center tenants and security firms like AIG, Martian McLennan, and Kroll, and their close ties with the intelligence community, etc., etc. These anomalies are not unrelated, but nevertheless became lost inside the chaos of that September morn, the aftermath, and subsequent cover-ups. Okay, so what does all this mean? Overall, a critical mass of brokers from the major government security brokerages in the Twin Towers had to be eliminated to create chaos in the government securities market. A situation needed to be created wherein $240 billion of covert securities could be electronically cleared without anyone asking questions, which happened when the Federal Reserve declared an emergency and invoked its emergency powers that very afternoon. On September 14th, the Securities and Exchange Commission declared a national emergency and for the first time in U.S. history invoked its emergency powers under the Securities Exchange Act Section 12K and eased regulatory restrictions for clearing and settling security trades for the next 15 days. These changes would have allowed the estimated $240 billion in covert government securities to be cleared upon maturity without the standard regulatory controls around identification of ownership. The towers needed to be demolished to create a big enough mess that the illicit activities taking place behind the scenes that morning could be hidden in the confusion of that day. Okay, now let's talk a little bit about who did it and how. 9/11 whistleblower Richard Andrew Grove was a software salesperson for a company called Silverstream. Silverstream's technology was on the cutting edge of internet solutions, offering software to web-enable the critical business functions of Fortune 500 companies, basically integrating and making available on the web the disparate legacy applications and mainframes while simultaneously streamlining workflow and traditional paper processes, with an end result being a lower cost of operation and more efficient transactions. Silverstream had built internet transactional and trading platforms for Merrill Lynch, Deutsche Bank, Bankers Trust, Alex Brown, and Morgan Stanley, to name a few. Leading up to 9/11, Silverstream was designing specialized accounting software for a major client, Marsh & McLennan. Marsh is the world's largest insurance brokerage and was located right below Cantor Fitzgerald in the North Tower. Approximately 295 Marsh employees were murdered that morning, along with other innocent victims and employees who either knew too much or too little about their chosen work environment. But most importantly, Silverstream provided a specific type of connectivity that was used to link AIG and Marsh & McLennan, the first two commercial companies on the planet to employ this type of transaction. What then were Marsh and AIG doing, and why did they need to leverage technologies that no other commercial entity on the face of the earth needed to use to conduct business? The recovered hard drives from the World Trade Center, combined with Richard Grove's testimony, give us some intriguing clues. Grove discovered that Silverstream was overbilling Marsh to the tune of $7 million extra dollars for fictitious and unneeded hardware. He also became aware of an exploitable flaw in the accounting software that had been sold to a variety of Marsh's clients and partners. When he brought this up to his superiors at Silverstream and others at Marsh, he was told to keep quiet and not to worry about it. But other friends of his at Marsh were also getting concerned and began documenting what was going on and raising concerns within the company. At last, they were finally granted a hearing with one of Marsh's high-ranking executives and were told to bring all their evidence to a hearing scheduled for 8:30 a.m. on September 11, 2001, on the 93rd floor. The high-ranking member of Marsh, who Grove did not name, would participate via teleconference from the safety of his home, while Marsh employees and potential whistleblowers, Gary Lasko, Catherine Lee, Ken Rice, Richard Bruhard, and John Ultzhofer would die in the meeting room in the North Tower with all their evidence when American Airlines Flight 11 would impact that very section of the building. Richard Grove, fortunately, got stuck in traffic that morning and didn't make it. Computer hard drives recovered from the World Trade Center show a spike in suspicious transfers that took place within the World Trade Center as the 9/11 attacks were unfolding. Richard Grove is convinced that these suspicious money transfers were performed electronically using Silverstream software, and that the overbilling of Marsh was hush money for the operations. It would certainly have helped clear up that $240 billion in securities and make it look like any of those companies might have done it. The recovered hard drives and financial transactions from 9/11 all show clear evidence that something was going on that morning. Marsh's CEO at the time was Jeffrey Greenberg, the son of Maurice Greenberg of AIG. Most insurance companies were hurting badly in late 2001 after $40 billion in insurance settlements had been paid out for the devastation caused by the 9/11 attacks. Yet one insurance company did not suffer quite the same losses as the other companies did. American International Group, or AIG as it turns out, is much more than an insurance company. With its long ties to the intelligence community, AIG was founded by OSS operative Cornelius V. Starr, two R's, the uncle of Clinton's friend Kenneth Starr. AIG currently operates a complex network of shell companies and other entities which operate internationally and have been used for clandestine intelligence gathering and other covert activities for decades. The company that ran security in the World Trade Center, Kroll Associates, was owned by AIG. The CEO of AIG on 9/11 was a guy named Maurice Greenberg, who was actually nominated for the position of Director of Central Intelligence after he authored a report for the Council on Foreign Relations, of which he's a high-ranking member, where he advocated that FBI and Drug Enforcement Agency agents operating abroad should not be allowed to act independently of either the ambassador or the CIA, lest pursuit of evidence or individuals for prosecution cause major foreign policy problems or complicate ongoing intelligence and diplomatic activities. Of course, this type of policy is essentially a continuation of things like Executive Order 12333 and the CIA-assisted contra-cocaine trafficking that went on as an immediate result. These backdoor agreements open the floodgates for government drug money laundering and narco-trafficking. Former LAPD narcotics detective turned whistleblower Michael Rupert has written a series of excellent articles documenting AIG's involvement in drug money laundering, undoubtedly revealing yet another motive for the invasion of Afghanistan, a country which currently produces over 90% of the world's heroin supply. Drugs are arguably the most profitable commodity on the entire international market, and drug money was undoubtedly a motive behind the invasion of Afghanistan and consequently the 9/11 attacks. While companies like AIG launder the drug money for big banks, the actual drug production and trafficking can be traced back to the same Iran-Contra affiliates like Richard Armitage and Frank Carlucci. Unfortunately, that rabbit hole is a bit too deep and off-topic to get into here. I will mention that DynCorp was heavily involved, as well as Stewart Air Force Base in upstate New York, where the two flights out of Boston crossed paths simultaneously and shut off their transponders before making their way to the Twin Towers. Many researchers believe that the MENA operation was moved to Stewart Air Force Base after Barry Seal got whacked. Richard Armitage was the Deputy Secretary of State on 9/11, and according to whistleblower Michael Springman, he was the man responsible for granting visas to 15 out of 19 of the 9/11 hijackers, allowing them to enter the U.S. and pursue flight training. Frank Carlucci is the chairman of the Carlyle Group and was in Washington, D.C. on 9/11, having just met with George H.W. Bush and the brother of Osama bin Laden on Carlyle Group business. Frank Carlucci was also the chairman of BDM International, a company that served as a front for State Department black operations. Frank Carlucci's employees at BDM International left to take charge of Stratasec, the World Trade Center and airport security firm. Corporate operating officer Barry W. McDaniel, an ex-military expert in logistics and materials distribution, and CEO Wirt Dexter Walker III, who is a distant Bush cousin from the Herbert Walker line, with an extensive history of managing CIA front companies. Marvin Bush, the president's brother, was also a board member at Stratasec. Although Stratasec maintained contracts for security upgrades, which were set to expire on September 11, 2001, they were not the company officially charged with World Trade Center security. This role was assigned to a risk management firm called Kroll Associates. Kroll's chairman, Jerome Hauer, was a longtime personal friend of ex-FBI counterterrorism expert John O'Neill, and was responsible for O'Neill's appointment as head of security for the World Trade Center just a few days prior to the 9/11 attacks. O'Neill is the world's leading expert on Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda, and was a potential 9/11 whistleblower with hard evidence of White House complicity in the protection and shielding of the 9/11 hijackers from all means of federal investigation. Al-Qaeda hijacking suspects were flagged by the Able Danger Terrorist Tracking Program, which was also shut down by the White House. Able Danger whistleblower Anthony Schaefer claims the U.S. government destroyed over 6 terabytes of data related to Able Danger, which he also claims identified 9/11 ringleader Mohammed Atta as early as February of 2000. Those atop the chain of command in the White House, military, and intelligence establishment deliberately ignored all the warning signs of an impending attack. A clever strategy of plausible deniability, which also served to portray those in charge as incompetent rather than complicit. In every major head throughout the chain of command on 9/11, from NORAD to the military, we see a repeated theme of complicity through negligence or incompetence. After 9/11, failure and incompetence was rewarded, and whistleblowers were silenced. Combined with the fact that 6 corporations control 90% of the media, and CIA operations like Mockingbird admit to taking over and subverting our U.S. media, we can understand how such a big lie could have been kept from the American public for so long. But if you stop and take the time to do your research, you'll find all the evidence is there, hidden beneath a mountain of disinfo and lies.
It's been 10 years since 9/11 happened, and we are left with hundreds, if not thousands, of unanswered questions about the 9/11 attacks. A transparently fraudulent 9/11 Commission report, which purposely failed to even mention the collapse of World Trade Center 7, and a host of ridiculous, so-called debunking websites, forums, and other literature, which have done absolutely nothing over the past 10 years to debunk anything other than cleverly selected strawman arguments, and have failed to stem the constant flow of new 9/11 information, which researchers have been uncovering and bringing out to the public. Instead, they continue to label truth seekers, including family members of people who died on 9/11, as conspiracy theorists, and devise clever propaganda designed to prevent the general public from looking any further into the evidence or the actual claims of the so-called conspiracy theorists. In this video, we will take a deeper look into the so-called investigations, which have provided us with the official story, and why they deserve a more thorough examination.
The Bush administration stalled government investigations into 9/11 for over 400 days.
A week after 9/11, letters containing anthrax spores were mailed to several news media offices and two senators who were perhaps a bit too vocal about opening an official investigation into 9/11. The anthrax used in the attacks was identified as an Ames strain, which means it had to have come from the U.S. Army Medical Research Institute of Infectious Diseases at Fort Detrick, Maryland. A member of that institute, Jerome Hauer, managed the National Institute of Health response to the anthrax attacks. Coincidentally, Hauer also warned the White House to start taking Cipro, an antibiotic which is effective against anthrax, a week before the attacks. Jerome Hauer also happened to be a managing director at Kroll Associates, which ran security at the World Trade Center up until the weekend before 9/11, when that role was personally handed off by Hauer to FBI agent John O'Neill, who would later die in the attacks, drawing strong suspicion that he was set up due to his knowledge of Al-Qaeda and the 9/11 hijackers, whom he was blocked from investigating while he was working at the FBI. In January 2002, President Bush personally asked Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle to limit the congressional investigation into the events of September 11th. The Bush administration only formed the 9/11 Commission after being prodded by the victims' families, who lobbied Congress for over a year to open the investigations. When the Bush administration finally did open a 9/11 investigation, it was described by some members as set up to fail.
The president has said only a minority of the commission can see a minority of the documents, and then they have to clear what they're going to say to the rest of the commission with the White House.
If you're one of those four that gets to see these documents, would that change your opinion?
No. They don't want any more eyeballs to see their documents than they can possibly get away with. It's a scam. It's absolutely disgusting.
They even attempted to appoint Henry Kissinger, a known cover-up mastermind, as head commissioner. He resigned after victims' family members asked him sensitive questions about his connections to the Bin Laden family and the Carlyle Group. Philip Zelikow wrote the conclusions for the report before the investigation ever began, and even then, any areas which did not support the official story were neither mentioned nor investigated by the 9/11 Commission. 6 out of 10 members of that commission have discussed on record how the government lied about the official story, and 70% of the questions posed by the victims' families were never answered or officially investigated. It's important to look at what happened to the evidence from 9/11. The day of 9/11, most of the FBI was in Monterey, California on an agency retreat.
Let's go to our State Department correspondent, Andrea Mitchell. Andrea, what can you tell us?
Well, this from the FBI. The State Department has been evacuated. There was a meeting going on in the operations center. Other top officials were in the Situation Room at the White House. Colin Powell is in Bogota, Colombia, on a two-day trip. But this very interesting information, Katie, Matt, and Tom, from the FBI, they had been operating a massive exercise from their hostage rescue unit. All of their top teams, about 50 personnel, helicopters, equipment, were in Monterey, California for the last 2 days, scheduled to fly back today commercially. So all of those people are out of place. It's fair to say, according to sources that we've talked to here at NBC, that the FBI rescue operations and other FBI operations are really in chaos right now because they can't reach their officials in New York. All of their phone lines are down, and now you've got all of their special experts on this stuck in Monterey, California, trying to get a military flight back because there are no longer commercial flights. So they are seriously out of pocket, and there is a real breakdown of the FBI anti-terror coordination team, which is, of course, the principal team that would lead any effort and was so effective under Jim Kastrom in New York City during the World Trade Center bombing and the TWA explosion, which, of course, turned out not to be terror.
Andrea, is the State Department...
This was essential for keeping the more experienced and honest members of the agency as far away from the crime scene as possible, while other agency insiders could be assigned to the investigations before their counterparts returned. Federal authorities such as FEMA and the CIA took immediate control over the crime scene and began whisking away evidence that very same night. Turner Construction, one of the primary contractors at Ground Zero, occupied the 38th floor of the North Tower and was involved in performing the fireproofing upgrades inside the towers. It has been noted that these upgrades were completed in the 3 years before 9/11 on floors that match up almost identically to the floors of impact and failure on 9/11. Once the cleanup was fully coordinated, the operations were consolidated under the control of two primary contractors, AMEC Construction Management and Bovis Lend-Lease. These are the two companies that were originally assigned to the areas of Ground Zero that included the North Tower, AMEC, and the South Tower, Bovis. A truly surprising fact is that at the time of the attacks on 9/11, AMEC had just completed a $258 million refurbishment of Wedge 1 of the Pentagon, which is exactly where American Airlines Flight 77 impacted that building. Arguments over the size of the hole of the Pentagon and whether it was a plane or a missile are, in my opinion, a convenient distraction from the much bigger picture of why that section of the building was targeted and by whom. On September 10, 2001, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld announced that $2.3 trillion in unadjusted funds were missing from the Pentagon budget. The very next day, the offices whose responsibility it was for tracking that money down were destroyed when American Airlines Flight 77 impacted that very section of the building. The only off-site backup for the Pentagon's black budget financial records was a secure federal office building in the World Trade Center complex. Strangely, it too was destroyed on 9/11. World Trade Center 7 was the largest CIA headquarters outside of Langley, Virginia, and housed offices involved in several large-scale federal investigations into massive stock market and accounting fraud. Not surprisingly, World Trade Center 7 was the first to be cleaned up and the evidence destroyed at Ground Zero.
So if the Twin Towers in Building 7 were brought down in a controlled demolition, and the scientific evidence points to nanothermite, then who could have produced this and who could have put it in the buildings and how did they get it there?
In the impact zone of the North Tower was a company called Marsh & McLennan, which at the time was the world's largest insurance brokerage company. One of Marsh's executives was a guy named L. Paul Bremer, who was also the chairman of the Congressional National Commission on Terrorism from 1999 to 2000 and the U.S. Ambassador at Large for Counterterrorism from 1986 to 1989. Instead of going to work on the day of 9/11 and dying inside the towers with hundreds of his employees, Bremer decided to go on MSNBC and tell the world that Osama bin Laden was behind the attacks and possibly Iraq and Iran. And then he demanded
the most severe military response we can come up with.
L. Paul Bremer was called away from Marsh in 2003 to become the Iraq occupation governor, a role he has been widely criticized for. So Bremer not only worked inside the buildings, but had offices directly in the impact zone of the South Tower where Flight 175 would hit. He missed work on 9/11 to give us the official story on national television and went on to be the Iraq occupation governor. You really can't get more connected to 9/11 than that. Oh wait, you can, sorry. I forgot to mention that Bremer was also the former manager for Kissinger Associates. He was a member of the board for AkzoNobel, the parent of International Paint Company, which produced a fireproofing application for skyscrapers called Interchar. Bremer was also on the international advisory board for the Japanese mining and machinery company Komatsu, which at the time had been involved in a joint venture agreement with Dresser Industries, the oil services intelligence front where Prescott Bush Sr. and George H.W. Bush got their start with Neil Mallon. Anyway, the Komatsu Dresser Mining Division operated from 1988 to 1997, and in July 1996 it patented a nanothermite demolition device that could, quote, demolish a concrete structure at high efficiency while preventing a secondary problem due to noise, flying chips and dust, and the like. As many of you know, residues of thermite, a highly energetic chemical mixture, have been confirmed in samples of World Trade Center dust, and the use of thermite at the World Trade Center was also revealed by environmental data. See the description for more links and sources. Scientific Applications International Corporation, a defense contractor with expertise in thermite-related technologies, played a large part in the NIST World Trade Center investigation. A few other names and companies inside the Twin Towers also worthy of further investigation include Craig Stapleton, who is married to Bush's cousin Dorothy Walker Bush. Stapleton was the president of Marsh Real Estate Advisors from 1982 to 2001. He was a member of the board of directors for Cendant, that was charged with massive accounting fraud in 1998, and went on to join Winston Partners, a privately owned investment firm founded in 1993 and led by George W. Bush's brother Marvin. Other very powerful and well-connected people worked in senior management at Marsh. These included Stephen Friedman, a senior principal at Marsh Capital and former partner at Goldman Sachs, who later became George W. Bush's top economic advisor. Friedman was also a member of the Brookings Institution, the Bilderberg Group, the Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board, and the board at InQtel, the investment firm founded by the CIA in 1998. InQtel invests in state-of-the-art technologies related to defense and intelligence work, including nano and chemical technologies, according to its website. In another interesting coincidence, Friedman belonged through Cornell University to a secret society called Quill and Dagger, the membership of which includes Paul Wolfowitz, Sandy Berger, and Stephen Hadley. Wolfowitz, the neocon deputy secretary of defense in the Bush administration, was the author in 1992 of the Wolfowitz Doctrine of Preemptive Warfare. He also made comments about a surprise-like Pearl Harbor months before 9/11 and met with Pakistani ISI General Mahmoud Ahmed in the week before 9/11. Berger, the national security advisor to President Clinton, was later caught stealing documents from the 9/11 Commission investigation. Berger was also the boss of White House counterterrorism czar Richard Clark, and together with Hadley, who was Condoleezza Rice's deputy, was responsible for delaying or obstructing Clark's plans to stop al-Qaeda in January of 2001. Jeffrey Greenberg resigned from Marsh & McLennan after being accused of serious financial crimes. The first plane of 9/11 flew directly into his company's secure computer room in the North Tower. Jeffrey Greenberg is a member of the Brookings Institution and the Trilateral Commission. Jeffrey Greenberg rose quickly through management at Marsh, having come there directly from AIG in 1995, and then becoming CEO just 4 years later. At Brookings, Greenberg hobnobbed with Lee Hamilton, co-chair of the 9/11 Commission. There's also Jim Pierce, another Bush cousin, who was managing director of Aon Corporation, who, according to the NIST report, modified unknown sections of Floor 83 in the South Tower in 1997. Jim Pierce had arranged a meeting on the 105th floor of the South Tower for that morning. Pierce survived that day, despite the fact that 12 people came to the meeting in the South Tower and 11 of them died. The location of the meeting had been changed the night before to the Millennium Hotel, where Pierce watched the South Tower as it was hit by the aircraft. Apparently, the meeting attendees were not all notified of the change in location. Another interesting character is Joseph Kasputis of Baseline Financial Service, which occupied the impact zone of the South Tower on floors 77 and 78, where United Airlines 175 impacted. Kasputis has a history of being well connected to the highest levels of government, as well as to the defense and intelligence industries. Kasputis worked from 1972 to 1977 for the U.S. Department of Commerce and Defense. He was also the deputy director of Nixon's White House task force that dealt with the Arab oil embargo of 1973, and was instrumental in the creation of the Department of Energy. Kasputis went on to run a large corporation called Primark that had offices in both towers on 9/11. One of the subsidiaries of Primark, the Analytical Sciences Corporation, TASC, worked with so-called black or top-secret programs. TASC also worked closely with the National Institute of Standards and Technology. Kasputis was also a member of the Logistics Management Institute, LMI, whose members included Paul Kaminsky of InQtel and General Dynamics, Charles DeBona of Halliburton, Skull and Bones member Joseph Samuel Nye, and Michael Daniels of Scientific Applications International Corporation. LMI's self-proclaimed role is advancing the science of government. Kasputis' connections to the DOE from 1977 through at least 1997 are interesting, considering that the DOE was developing thermite ignition devices as early as 1983. Joseph Kasputis went on to become the CEO of Baseline Financial Services, which was directly in the impact zone on the 78th floor of the South Tower. According to NIST, Kasputis Baseline Financial modified the southeast corner of floor 78 in 1999, exactly where the aircraft hit on 9/11. Floors 77 and 78 were upgraded for fireproofing in June and April of 1998, respectively. Another company of interest on floor 91, just above the impact zone for the South Tower, was Washington Group International. This company was known primarily as a construction and mining firm, and it had just acquired Raytheon Engineers in July of 2000. In 1996, Washington took over Morrison Knudsen, an engineering and construction firm that had a history of working on large-scale projects around the world, including in China, Iran, Afghanistan, and Saudi Arabia. The Army Corps of Engineers hired Morrison Knudsen to demolish over 200 buildings in 1995. One of the DOE facilities for which Washington was responsible well before 9/11 was the Savannah River site near Aiken, South Carolina. In February of 1997, Lawrence Livermore National Labs and the Savannah River site signed an agreement of cooperation to share technology. Savannah went on to add developing Sol-Gel technology for fuels and other applications to its portfolio. Sol-Gel technology is utilized by Lawrence Livermore National Laboratories for making nanothermites. In another coincidence, Savannah River technology staff participated in the search and rescue operations at Ground Zero by providing unique tools. Just before 9/11, Washington was going through a tough time financially and sought Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection. Securities and Exchange Commission documents show that Washington made court-ordered pre-petition payments as part of these proceedings to a number of companies, including Komatsu. Washington also made payments to Greenhorn and O'Mara, whose employee, Teresa McAllister, was a lead author of the FEMA and NIST reports on the World Trade Center disaster, and to Sumitomo Bank, which was closely allied with Komatsu. Building 7 was a 47-story federal office building in the World Trade Center site, which collapsed at 5:20 p.m. on the afternoon of 9/11. This building was home to the CIA, in fact, the largest CIA headquarters outside of Langley, Virginia. It also housed offices for the Secret Service and the Securities and Exchange Commission. One of the most interesting tenants, however, was then-Mayor Giuliani's Office of Emergency Management and its Emergency Command Center on the 23rd floor. This floor received $15 million worth of renovations, including independent and secure air and water supplies, and bullet and bomb-resistant windows designed to withstand 200-mile-per-hour winds. Mayor Giuliani was a former U.S. prosecutor for the South District of New York from 1983 to 1989, who was in charge of investigating the terrorist financing Bank of Credit and Commerce International. After he left his job as a prosecutor to start a political career, he worked for a law firm called White & Case that actually represented BCCI. So he went from prosecuting the BCCI to working for a law firm which defended the BCCI. This was likely his foot in the door of this underground corporate criminal network. Giuliani would later help to destroy all the crime scene evidence from Ground Zero. Giuliani's sidekick on 9/11 was Police Commissioner Bernard Kerik, who appeared to be coaching some of Rudy's actions that day, keeping him away from the media and even answering questions for him about explosives in the buildings. In fact, Bernard Kerik gave us the first official government pronouncement that no explosives were involved in the destruction of the World Trade Center buildings. Kerik's department was also the same one that found that pristine, completely undamaged hijacker's passport, which survived a plane impact and fireball, which destroyed two titanium black boxes and three towers. Yeah. Kerik would later receive a nomination from President Bush to become Director of Homeland Security, which he declined for personal and political reasons, and instead took a job training the Iraqi police force in Iraq alongside L. Paul Bremer. Both men are credited for turning Iraq into the unwinnable quagmire it is today. In February of 2010, Kerik was sentenced to 4 years in federal prison for conspiracy and fraud charges, unrelated to the crimes of 9/11, unfortunately, but it still goes to show you what kind of person he is. Definitely the kind of person you'd want inside the New York City police force during a staged event like 9/11. And lastly, we have the Pentagon. It's certainly peculiar, to say the least, that Al-Qaeda terrorists hell-bent on destroying the USA would not crash their plane into the north wing of the Pentagon, where all the most important offices were, like Donald Rumsfeld, John Ashcroft, etc., and that they would instead choose to target the one section of the Pentagon that had most recently been refurbished to withstand missile impacts. It's also interesting to note that the company which completed the $258 million refurbishment to Wedge 1 of the Pentagon was also hired as a contractor to clean up Ground Zero in New York City. Wedge 1 also coincidentally housed the Pentagon's budget analyst office, where DoD staffers were working on the mystery of the $2.3 trillion that was reported missing by Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld in a press conference the day before 9/11. The Pentagon's comptroller in charge of that money at the time was an interesting fellow named Dov Zakheim, a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, the International Institute for Strategic Studies, and a contributor to the neocon think tank Project for the New American Century. Zakheim helped write the PNAC document Rebuilding America's Defenses, in which he is credited for the line which states, "Further, the process of transformation, even if it brings revolutionary change, is likely to be a long one, absent some catastrophic and catalyzing event, like a new Pearl Harbor." Several members of the Bush administration, including President Bush himself, would later refer to 9/11 as a new Pearl Harbor.
A respected and established voice in the intelligence community, his views were eagerly accepted. And Dov went from his position at Systems Planning Corporation to become the comptroller of the Pentagon in May of 2001. Perhaps not so coincidentally, it was an SPC subsidiary, Tridata Corporation, that oversaw the investigation after the terrorist attacks on the World Trade Center in 1993. SPC, according to their official website, specializes in many areas of defense technology production and manufacture, including a system developed by their radar physics group called the Flight Termination System, or FTS.
This is a system used to destroy target drones, craft that would be fired on by test aircraft or weaponry, in the event of malfunctions or misses. This highly sophisticated wargame technology allows the control of several drones from a remote location on varying frequencies and has a range of several hundred miles. This technology can be used on many different types of aircraft, including large passenger jets. According to the SPC website, a recent customer at that time was Eglin Air Force Base, located in Florida. Eglin is very near another Air Force Base in Florida, MacDill Air Force Base, where Dov Zakheim contracted to send at least 32 Boeing 767 aircraft as part of the Boeing-Pentagon tanker lease agreement. As the events of September 11, 2001 occurred, little was mentioned about these strange coincidences and the proximity of Dov Zakheim and his group. Since there was little physical evidence remaining after the events, investigators were only left with photographic and anecdotal evidence. This is a photograph of the flight termination system module from their site. Note it has a cylindrical shape and is consistent with the size and shape of the object observed under the fuselage of Flight 175. The Boeing lease deal involved the replacement of the aging KC-135 tanker fleet with these smaller, more efficient Boeing 767s, which were to be leased by Dov Zakheim's group. The planes were to be refitted with refueling equipment, including lines and nozzle assemblies. In this enlargement of Flight 175, we can clearly see a cylindrical object under the fuselage and a structure that appears to be attached to the right underside of the rear fuselage section. When seen in comparison, it is obvious that the plane approaching the Trade Center has both these structures, the FTS module, and the mid-air refueling equipment, as configured on the modified Boeing 767 tankers. Of particular interest is the long tube-like anomalous structure under the rear fuselage area of 175. This structure runs along the right rear bottom of the plane. The equipment attached to the underside of the plane which hit the World Trade Center is identical in every single way to the Boeing 767s issued by Dov Zakheim.
Whoa, whoa, whoa. Bring it back.
The video you're watching now came from Loose Change First Edition.
Did you catch that?
It appears to show the FTS pod self-destructing just before impact.
Also, notice that the flash is reflected in the fuselage of the plane. The flash is also present in footage taken by Evan Fairbanks, Jennifer Spell, and CNN. Al-Qaeda certainly couldn't die this equipment at Logan International Airport. And even if they did, the flight crew would have noticed it. So where did this plane come from?
Another interesting piece of 9/11 evidence is the last 12 seconds of UA-175. Since every amateur videographer in New York City had their cameras pointed up at the burning Tower 1, the second plane strike was filmed from nearly every conceivable angle. Expert analysis of this plane leads to some startling revelations. First, there is the expertly controlled flight characteristics of this plane. During its last 12 seconds of flight, UA-175 made a single corrective maneuver so perfectly timed and executed that it's unlikely it was piloted by human hands.
One of the things that jumped out at me when I looked at the footage of the video of Flight 175 as it went into the World Trade Center is it appeared to me that there was something on the under fuselage of that aircraft that did not belong there, at least not with a commercial airliner. Now, I'll tell you where I have seen attachments that look like that on military aircraft. So the question we have to answer now is, was that the commercial airliner that hit the World Trade Center, or possibly was it an aircraft that looked very similar but was a military type airplane?
All the recorded sources, all the different photographic evidence that was produced by CNN and ABC, they all show this pod. It's there. You can see it with your own eyes. And in my professional opinion, that there was a pod attached to the bottom of that aircraft, and therefore it was not United Airlines Flight 175.
If you take a careful look at the flight paths of American Airlines 11 and UA-175, the two flights that took off from Boston's Logan Airport and crashed into the Twin Towers, you'll find a major clue. Not only did both these planes cross paths directly over Stewart Air Force Base, but they did so at the exact same time. Another odd synchronicity is Flight 93, which had been sitting on the tarmac delayed at the airport for nearly 40 minutes with no explanation. Originally scheduled to take off at 8:01 a.m., it was delayed until the moment that Flight AA-11 crashed into the North Tower at 8:43 a.m. Another interesting piece of evidence that ties Stewart Air Force Base to the center of this 9/11 conspiracy is the white mystery plane spotted over Washington and the Pentagon. Through careful investigation, we've been able to map out the flight paths of these two ominous aircraft, which have been identified as E-4Bs, a type of aircraft that the military uses as mobile command posts. What concerns me is that both of these aircraft took off from and landed at Stewart Air Force Base. Another interesting coincidence I found was that Flight 93 turned around directly over Hopkins Airport, and Flight 77 turned around directly over Tri-State Airport. Webster Tarpley has done some of the most thorough research into the war game exercises that were taking place on the day of 9/11. But this white mystery plane, the Doomsday Plane, what was it doing over the Pentagon and the White House on 9/11? Who was flying in that plane? What were they doing? Being the comptroller for the Pentagon and the chief financial officer, you have to kind of wonder what Dov Zakheim was doing on 9/11 and what his connections were to the $2.3 trillion that were missing from the Pentagon the day before 9/11.
If anything, the individuals and organizations outlined in this video are at least as suspicious as the 19 hijackers themselves.
They have nothing.
Now, most students of 9/11 are unaware of the reasons, the rationale why they had to fake the planes. This excellent video, of course, assumes the real planes that were really targeted for those specific locations of the World Trade Center. But the fact is, while they originally planned to use remote-controlled drones, very much as he described, where Dov Zakheim had a company that developed them, they couldn't do it because there were too many chances something would go wrong. For example, pilots for 9/11 Truth, in the aftermath of the attacks on the buildings, used flight simulators to see if they could hit a 208-foot wide building traveling over 400 miles an hour. And they tried like 20 times and managed to do it once. Well, it wouldn't do to have one of these planes fly toward one of the Twin Towers and miss it and then have to loop around. That would have been faintly absurd. But there was a more important reason. They discovered that, in fact, it was physically impossible for those planes to come all the way into the building before they exploded. They would have crumbled up against the exterior surface of the buildings, body, seats, luggage, wings, tail, fallen to the ground. The engines would have entered the building, but only parts of the plane. Most of it would have remained external. Plus, the immense friction generated by the impact would almost certainly have also caused the plane to explode, but external to the building. They had to get the planes inside the building before they would explode to create the psychological impression of cause-effect that the planes had hit the building, the intense fire had caused the steel to weaken, and led to the collapse of the buildings. None of that, of course, is true. But here's yet another consideration that most students, even sophisticated, do not understand. They had to drain the sprinkler systems of water, or they would have extinguished the very modest fires that remained after the spectacular fireballs that were created by pre-positioned jet fuel, napalm, whatever. They had it all set up that way. But they couldn't, those were extinguished in the first 15 or 20 seconds. And the sprinkler systems would have extinguished any fires that remained. They had to drain the sprinkler systems. They did that by setting off explosions in the sub-basements of the North and the South Tower that were timed to coincide with the impacts of the planes, which were then going to be explained by jet fuel falling through the elevator shafts to cause explosions in the sub-basement. All that was nonsense. The elevator shafts were staggered every 30 floors. You'd have to get up and go to another elevator and so forth. There were like two elevators that went all the way from the top to the bottom. Now, William Rodriguez was a senior custodian in the North Tower and reported not only about the massive explosion in the North Tower, but how one of his fellow custodians was trapped in an elevator and survived, which would not have been the case had that scenario taken place. Moreover, when he came here to Madison and we had dinner, he told me and Kevin Barrett how he watched as the sub-basement filled up with water, which was when I realized that the purpose of those explosions, which actually occurred 14 and 17 seconds before the purported impact of the planes, when you compare the seismic data maintained by Columbia University's Lamont Laboratory and the official radar data for the impacts. So they had a hand-eye coordination problem. But they had to have certainty that those planes would be impacting the building at the same time they set off the explosions in the sub-basement. They couldn't leave anything to chance. They could not use real planes for the reasons I've explained. And to review what I've explained here, go to the Midwest 9/11 Truth Conference Part 2 and check it out. This is a crucial point that explains the rationale for why they had to fake the planes in New York. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, inviting you to stand by for the new JFK show, which will follow right after this break.
We can now say with moral certainty and considerable scientific authority that the death of JFK was committed by a meticulously executed conspiracy which was obscured by an extensive cover-up. Murder in Dealey Plaza, edited by James Fetzer, goes to the heart of the JFK assassination. You'll read new and up-to-date information regarding the Secret Service, the Lincoln limousine, the medical evidence, the cover-up, altering the film, framing the patsy, and the silent historians. Also, 16 smoking guns, each one crushing the government's lone assassin scenario. A world-class chronology of November 22nd, 1963. Chapters by David W. Mantic, Gary Aguilar, Vincent Palomara, Douglas Weldon, Jack White, Ira David Wood III, James H. Fetzer, Doug Horn, and a classic essay by Bertrand Russell. The complete story in the pages of one single book, edited by James H. Fetzer. Read it now. Read it again. You'll use it as a reference. Murder in Dealey Plaza. Available at Amazon.com and major bookstores around the world. It's murder.
Less than 3% of you people read books. But less than 15% of you read newspapers. Right now, there is a whole, an entire generation that never knew anything that didn't come out of this tube. This tube can make or break presidents, popes, prime ministers. Television is not the truth. Television is a circus, a carnival, a traveling troupe of acrobats, storytellers, dancers, singers, jugglers, sideshow freaks, lion tamers, and football players. We deal in illusions, man. None of it is true. But you people sit there day after day, night after night, all ages, colors, creeds.
Broadcasting live on network radio.
So turn off your television sets. Turn them off now. Turn them off and leave them off.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade.
It looks like one of those scenes of an old building being purposely dynamited and blown.
When we are successful,
I'm just a patsy.
And we will be.
You ready to make to come to the microphone, so we'll listen to them.
A new world order.
So my name's Robbie Parker.
It might have appeared that way, but from my close-up inspection, there's no evidence of a plane having crashed anywhere near the Pentagon.
Let us never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories concerning the attacks of September the 11th.
President Kennedy died at 1 p.m.
Live from the Media Broadcasting Center.
Welcome to the new JFK show, number 80. All right, just a show or so ago, we were trying to delve into the Masons, and Dr. Fetzer said, hey, we're going to have to find someone who knows something about the Masons. However, we didn't realize that the man in the engineer's chair had done exhaustive research on the Masons and actually held up the picture that you see now, the Holy Bible of the Masons. So I'm going to concede from the very beginning that I hear it come up all the time. I'm completely in the dark about it. I know people who are Masons. They're as good as rain. So we're going to go ahead and take Chance out of the engineer's chair and into the guest chair and try to, along with our audience, try to understand the Masons and where they fit in. All right, so Chance, go ahead.
All right. Well, like you said, we were talking to Don, and Don was having some slides on the screen, and he produced basically what was like a stepladder of pyramids that is kind of showing the 33 steps of the Freemasons. And he was kind of approached by one of you. I believe it might have even been Jim had mentioned, you know, how authentic is this picture? And he kind of, you know, he did admit it's one of these things from the internet, so we weren't able to verify it. And that's when I had mentioned, you know, I have this holy Freemason Bible right here that you see on the screen. And I actually opened it up to the first couple of pages, and it shows you here a little bit of a diagram of the different degrees. I have a bit of a close-up of the 32 degrees of the Freemasonry that basically you can get into and you can make your way up through. It's that
Chance. Yeah, Chance, what I said to Don was it looked to me like this very odd diagram was representing the 33 degrees of Masonry, and he couldn't confirm it. But it seemed obvious to me because you had these 33 steps right up to the top, the 33rd, and that's when, you know, he was suggesting we needed more research on it, and it turned out you had already done it.
Yeah, I kind of, you know, not only watch all these shows and I'm a big fan of it, but it's because I'm into this research as well. So what had basically happened was I wanted to get a little bit more of my JFK angle of how the Masons fit into this. I think one of the first things I wanted to do, though, is I wanted to show a little bit of a five-minute video of one of JFK's speeches that everyone kind of references. This has a little bit of a video overlay with it that includes some Masonic angle. It shows some pictures. It kind of goes along with what he's saying in the speech. These guys won't be able to see it right now, but when you see the finished copy on YouTube, or if you're watching at home right now, you'll be able to see it. And it just kind of is going to set the tone. So we'll be back in about 5 minutes right after this short video, and I know that any one of the gentlemen on the panel I'm with tonight will be able to tell me probably exactly where this speech is from. It's JFK's famous secret society speech. We'll be right back.
President John F. Kennedy.
Ladies and gentlemen, the very word secrecy is repugnant in a free and open society. And we are, as a people, inherently and historically opposed to secret societies, to secret oaths, and to secret proceedings. We decided long ago that the dangers of excessive and unwarranted concealment of pertinent facts far outweighed the dangers which are cited to justify it. Even today, there is little value in opposing the threat of a closed society by imitating its arbitrary restrictions. Even today, there is little value in ensuring the survival of our nation if our traditions do not survive with it.
And there is very grave danger that an announced need for increased security will be seized upon by those anxious to expand its meaning to the very limits of official censorship and concealment. That I do not intend to permit to the extent that it's in my control. And no official of my administration, whether his rank is high or low, civilian or military, should interpret my words here tonight as an excuse to censor the news, to stifle dissent, to cover up our mistakes, or to withhold from the press and the public the facts they deserve to know. For we are opposed around the world by a monolithic and ruthless conspiracy that relies primarily on covert means for expanding its sphere of influence, on infiltration instead of invasion, on subversion instead of elections, on intimidation instead of free choice, on guerrillas by night instead of armies by day. It is a system which has conscripted vast human and material resources into the building of a tightly knit, highly efficient machine that combines military, diplomatic, intelligence, economic, scientific, and political operations. Its preparations are concealed, not published. Its mistakes are buried, not headlined. Its dissenters are silenced, not praised.
Praised. No expenditure is questioned, no rumor is printed, no secret is revealed. No president should fear public scrutiny of his program, for from that scrutiny comes understanding, and from that understanding comes support or opposition, and both are necessary. I am not asking your newspapers to support an administration, but I am asking your help in the tremendous task of informing and alerting the American people. For I have complete confidence. In the response and dedication of our citizens, whenever they are fully informed. I not only could not stifle controversy among your readers, I welcome it. This administration intends to be candid about its errors. For as a wise man once said, an error doesn't become a mistake until you refuse to correct it. We intend to accept full responsibility for our errors, and we expect you to point them out when we miss them. Without debate, without criticism, no administration and no country can succeed, and no republic can survive. That is why the Athenian lawmaker Solon decreed it a crime for any citizen to shrink from controversy. And that is why our press was protected by the First Amendment, the only business in America specifically protected by the Constitution, not primarily to amuse and entertain, not to emphasize the trivial and the sentimental, not to simply give the public what it wants, but to inform, to arouse, to reflect, to state our dangers and our opportunities, to indicate our crises and our choices, to lead, mold, educate, and sometimes even anger public opinion. This means greater coverage and analysis of international news, for it is no longer far away and foreign, but close at hand and local. It means greater attention to improved understanding of the news, as well as improved transmission. And it means, finally, that government at all levels must meet its obligation to provide you with the fullest possible information outside the narrowest limits of national security. And so it is to the printing press, to the recorder of man's deeds, the keeper of his conscience, the courier of his news, we look for strength and assistance, confident that with your help, man will be what he was born to be, free and
independent.
Suing to block limits on carbon pollution from power plants. Schimmel's son.
You're back.
All right, that was the President of the United States talking about the importance of the press and their job for keeping our country the way it is. So he was actually talking to the American Newspaper Association there. So do you want to weigh in there on that, Jim, first?
No, I think it's a very important...
Yeah, go ahead, Jim.
We've got some kind of duplication or echo there, Gary. But yes, this was a terribly important speech because he's emphasizing the crucial role of the newspapers, too, as envisioned by our founding fathers. Thomas Jefferson once explained that if he had to choose between newspapers without a government or a government without newspapers, he'd prefer newspapers without a government, but he had no anticipation that the news media could become as controlled, as propagandistic, as much an instrument of disinformation as it is today in the United States of America.
Absolutely. So, Chance, they had several Masonic references in there. Can you straighten us out about that?
Well, some of the Mason stuff that we want to get into, like we're seeing on the screen, the top level of the Masons is this 33rd degree. Now, the 33rd degree isn't just something that you're going to bump into because you're a good Mason. This is only for those who contribute to what's known as the Great Work. The Great Work is the New World Order, one world totalitarian socialist government ruled by an illuminated man. And the illuminated man is supposed to have the number 666. This is what they know. This is how they roll. This is what the 33rd degree does. So they have very specific Masonic numbers. Some of the numbers you're going to see, obviously, is the 33rd, the 33, 13, and 11. Now, you will see a lot of these repeating numbers where the numbers are basically like you're 88, you're 22, all these, and it's almost like they're kind of implementing like a telltale sign. Or when you see the numbers doubled, like for example, Sandy Hook, we saw 26 was the number. Well, the Freemasons or the Babylonian mystery schools would know 13 times 2, 26. Obviously, we're in on it. Or it's kind of a sign to them that, you know, they can know through the numbers. That's why.
What about the number 7? That comes up all the time.
Well, different numbers in numerology, when you're looking at some of the sacred geometry in that, 7 is a very big number when they're doing depicting. When you look in English geometria, they use this 7 as part of their code system to figure out the numbers and the values that are going into words through their numeric value. So looking at the Mason numbers, because that's the ones that we really want to focus in on, it doesn't take too long to start to get through November 22nd, which is the 11th month. We're looking at the 22nd day. You know, it start to add this up. We could almost end this here on the Masons because it's 33. And it's blatant in your face type of stuff that they like to kind of just leave with you so that, you know, you have this bad taste in your mouth. You don't really know why, but it's the symbology that's there. They don't just put a sign, it was us. They leave the symbols there for you to be able to figure out.
I do realize that almost every false flag is loaded with 7s, 33s, and, numbers. I can't think of them all offhand, but I do know that 7's like 214, like flight 214. If you add those numbers, it's a 7. 61 injured, that's a 7 right there. I just see it all the time.
Well, I wanted to keep some of the – you could go deep into this stuff, but just to keep it towards the Kennedy, we look at Texas or where JFK was shot, and just showing on this map right here – we're looking at the 33rd parallel. Okay, so it's just it's not like the smoking gun that's going to, you know, case closed, but one after another, you just start to think, okay, well, maybe there is something here. How do you get into this? How do the Freemasons work? And you start to just look into all of this, and I wanted to pull up a picture of Dealey Plaza. And one of the first things you see from an overview is the shape of this, of the plaza there. Now, I've never been there myself, but I know from the video you guys have posted that, that you guys have been there and you know what's going on there. So I did a little bit of an overlay just to kind of draw a picture. And one of the first Masonic things we see here is the triangles. And it's not just one. I've got the black one around the outline of the large triangle. It's kind of in a pyramid shape. But then we have these half triangles that are back to back. I've got one in red and I've got one in the yellow there. And these basically, you know, you guys obviously are more familiar with the names of the streets and where the kill spot and all that was. But this is what people are focused on. And these occult Illuminati people, these Masons, are taking the symbology and the energy and all of this type of stuff. It all is a symbolic type of thing. So now, when we see the three triangles right here, what the freeway or the underpass is kind of contributing to is it's cutting off the top of the triangle itself. And you see right here is three underpasses, or the triple underpass that people like to reference, where JFK sped away and basically made his escape to try and, you know, get taken off to Parkland and hopefully someone could put him back together again, and that never worked. But this triple underpass here, it basically represents Masonically where it is on the overlay. I'll just pull down one more slide. Now you can see I drew in a blue line right here, because that's cutting off the capstone of not one, not two, but three pyramids. So when we start looking for the 666, we've got three pyramids, three capstones, 3 + 3 = 6. There's one. Okay, so we just start going through all the numbers and going through how this all works. And like I said, it's not the smoking gun that's going to definitively say, you know, I've solved the case, I know what's going on. But it is slowly but surely adding up, and you start to see the Masonic connection.
Yeah, as Jim Garrison once said, each and every one of these could be a coincidence, but the steady accumulation of them is not. All right, now, I've shown Dr. Fetzer, I've shown Larry, if you stand on the overpass and you look at Dealey Plaza, there is a building that makes a perfect pyramid over Dealey Plaza. I put in the beginning of every single JFK show that I make. At the very beginning, you can see the pyramid.
I guess what I'm going to have to do, you're advancing beyond where I was. I was going to ask you guys if you guys knew what this building was right here. Because in the background,
about,
they've got this creepy little pyramid. And that freaks me out. Okay, I've never been there. I know this wasn't there at the time, obviously, but it's been put there since.
Yeah, it's kind of in the back.
Kind of like
now
in your face.
Imagine how much engineering and how much money it took to make sure that the building that was built later on would make a perfect pyramid overlooking Dealey Plaza from the middle of the overpass on the railroad tracks.
There is a lot of planning going into this, and I think that there's more than generations of planning that have gone into some of the types of things that we see. Now, just to take us away from Dallas for a minute, you guys are probably familiar with what this structure is. Anyone on the panel here got an idea?
The Vatican.
Is that the Vatican?
Yeah.
The
more specifically, though, you know what that's called at the Vatican?
Yes.
Called the Temple of the Sun. Okay, and what we see in the middle is the phallic symbol or the obelisk that's in the middle, and then you see you see basically the representation of kind of like what are those things called? Your horoscope or your zodiac on the ground there. That's the Temple of the Sun. But around the outside is those walls that go around, and they're in half formations. Now, they're in half formations at the Vatican, but when I look in Dealey Plaza, I find the same structure in quarter formations representing the four quarters or the four seasons of the year. And I've pointed one of them out is at the top on the grassy knoll, which is right here. There is another one right at the bottom here. This would be right in front of, I believe, this doorway around here is where Oswald was shot. when he goes into the underground garage.
No, that's much further down.
That was at City Hall. City Hall.
Okay. Like I said, you guys have been right there. I haven't.
You can see the jail. The second one is where Jack Ruby was on the top level right there. He did pretty much rot there, and a lot of the people in jail could see what had gone on. And it wasn't what the Warren Commission was saying, so I didn't really want to talk to them very much.
Now, the Temple of the Sun is basically an outdoor temple, and it's for the mystery schools of Osiris and of Ra, and this is part of the name when you start to see Isis, Ra, and El, and they combine them all into Isriel. You know what I mean? We're starting to see which parts of the mystery Babylonian schools are leaving their signatures here. So we see this temple, which is an outdoor temple in the Vatican, which is the same setup we have here, but it's kind of encompassing most of Dealey Plaza here in all the different sides. And like I said, you guys are a little more familiar with what is actually on the ground there and everything that's going down there. So, like I said, I'll let you describe which places these are located in, like off of which street. There's one a little bit lower, just adjacent, and then one at the very bottom of the screen, which is kind of opposite of the grassy knoll, completely other side of the pyramid structure.
Yeah, that's Commerce Street there on the bottom, and then it's Main Street in the middle, and then Elm on top.
Okay,
and then Houston is the Houston Street makes the base of your triangle there.
Now just to add insult to injury, in the Temple of the Sun in the Vatican, we saw the obelisk, and at Dealey Plaza, we have the same obelisk type structure. And just to hold on, someone has said something. Go ahead. No, okay. No,
oh, I think something just clunked or whatever.
Okay. Now, just to quickly find some more of these sixes that I was referencing when they're talking about the 666, the official story says that window that I have up there circled the sixth floor. Okay, so there's another six in Dealey Plaza, the sixth floor window. And the official story talks about there was three shots and three wounds. I know that everyone knows how complete BS that is right there, but that gives you your 3 plus 3, which is another 6. So we have your 666.
What's that pine cone up there, Chance?
Well, actually, that one's not a pine cone. That one's the illuminated torch, which is the flame or the light or Lucifer or the knowledge. Okay, so once again, they're just placing this more and more on top of it. It's like a disgrace when you look at JFK's grave and you see the illuminated flame. It's like, we were here, we did this. Ha ha ha, in your face. It's right in front of your face and people don't see it. So The obelisk is right here. This is the phallic or the missing penis of Osiris, which is a 14-part step, and they only have 13 parts represented, and that's why you see this exact kind of setup in every obelisk. Now, just to throw some of the numbers out there, the obelisk at the Vatican, the obelisk at Washington, D.C., they're both 555 feet tall. Who cares about that? Well, in inches, that's 6,660 inches. Okay, 666 again. So just one after another just keeps piling up. Like, I believe one of Jim Fetzer's guests kept talking about correlations of constellations of all of these anomalies that just keep adding up. And just the amount of the odds of this happening, the odds against chance of all these correlations happening are just boom, mind-blowing. So, I mean, one after another, they just keep adding up. Now, I wanted to just kind of show people whereabouts in Dealey Plaza is this said obelisk. It's right here in this little red center here. Mm-hmm. And I'm just going to kind of scroll down through a couple of these. Sorry about the little bit harder doing this while you're talking and yakking at the same time. So
yeah, just, that's why I didn't want to do it last week, Jay.
So just to point out an overview of the different structures, like I said, we've got the four different sections of the Temple of the Sun and the obelisk all completely right there. That is pretty much surrounding the kill zone, where it comes around the corner the entire time that you're there, and it's It's there. It's a heavy Masonic presence that pretty much can't be denied at this point.
No, I'm sure this is all a coincidence.
Well, I guess we can get into more coincidence. Like Gary said, we've got this building that's back
here. That's the one right there.
Now, I believe beside it is the school book depository, so behind it, this would be, I would ask Jim, because I know I've seen
Daltex.
Him.
Daltex.
That's Daltex building,
okay. Yep. Awesome. You guys are all over this. I'm seriously dealing. Like, I'm normally in the background here, but you guys are, like, the best JFK team I've
seen. And the record building is from there where Harry Weatherford fired one of his shots.
Yeah, they found
to the right of the pyramid.
On top of the county records building, they found shell casings in the 70s up on the roof there.
Yeah, wonder why.
Iowa Don, he just finished playing the Secret Society speech by JFK. Now, you're the one that brought up all this Masonic stuff and all that, so what are you thinking about?
More, just in case.
Yeah, we'll let Chance do his thing here, and then
we'll
start talking.
Now I've got one conspiracy theory to debunk, because I've seen some other people try and bring up a little bit of research on what I'm talking about, but I think their math was wrong, so I'm going to just help them out with their math. They are trying to initiate the 666 again, and what they're doing is bringing up some of the research that I found, where on November 22nd, 1307, is when the papal bull was issued, and they basically went on a rampage, killing what the Pope and them was basically doing, was going around and executing as many of these ancient Freemasons, because they weren't actually called the Masons back then. They were more like the Knights Templar, and it's just one of these things that just happens to be a coincidence. Now, the conspiracy theorists who can't do math say that this happened in 1307 on November 22nd, the exact day, and I agree with that. It did actually happen, but they're saying that's 666 years ago. Now, I did the math, and 1963 take away 1307 is only 656. Okay, so they're a little bit off. Maybe they got their conspiracies wrong, or maybe people couldn't wait to kill Kennedy 10 more years to make that happen. But it's to bring up this part of it is where you start to get into the fact that JFK had three wounds. Apparently, I'm going by what the official story is, because obviously if we went by what the truth is, it'd be out of control how many wounds and bullets happened. But the back, the throat, and the head are the official story wounds. Now,
yeah, but Chance, he was hit twice or even three times in the head. And there were 10, 11, or 12 shots fired altogether. There were three misses, and there were other 1 to 3 shots in Conway.
Yeah, oh yeah, yeah, yeah. I know what you're saying, but I'm saying...
Yeah, but the official word by Walter Cronkite, three shots.
Yeah, now they're saying he was wounded in the back, throat, and head. Well, Hiram Abiff, who is what they use as the Masonic initiate, the three wounds to Hiram Abiff when he was killed, and if you guys don't know the story of Hiram Abiff, he's a very well-known Masonic leader who basically they base their initiations on. He was wounded in the back, the throat, and the head.
Now,
it wasn't really the Hiram Abiff angle that I'm going at, but looking at this, what I have on screen about the papal bull and all that, about killing all of these people, the Pope had Jack Dumoulin, which is the head grand poobah of all Masons and all Knights Templar back in the day, just Jack Dumoulin, he was executed and burned at the stake by the Pope back when this papal bull or when all this type of thing was happening. So now, the three wounds of the back, head, and throat are basically more like a representation of the three things that they were talking about with ignorance, superstition, and fear that is actually corresponding with the church, state, and the mob. Now, the mob would be actually us or the population. So, kind of like a summary conclusion to kind of wrap it up. I had to actually write this down. I'll kind of read off my notes here. I hate reading because God knows I get it wrong a lot of the time, but to scratch through my own chicken scratch, we've got the Knights of Malta, the Scottish Rite of Freemason, the Order of St. John of Jerusalem, and the Order of the Rosen Cross are all different branches of the Knights Templar. So when you understand that JFK was assassinated in an outdoor Temple of the Sun by the Knights Templar in a combination of different adepts from different branches of the mystery schools controlled by the Templars, then you start to have an idea. He was also killed at the most highest time of the sun during the day. I believe that was correct. It was noon hour or 12:30 somewhere.
Well, it was supposed to be noon, but they were running a half an hour late. So he was actually killed at 12:30.
So this is when the sun is at the highest of highs.
But the plan was to take him out at noon.
So basically, when in ancient times, when someone is working at a time of the sun at the highest of highs, they're apparently doing their father's work in the temple. And like we said, this is an outdoor temple of the sun. And what happened in Daly Plaza to JFK was the revenge killing of the Knights Templar against the church, state, and mob, because JFK is the first and only Catholic president. And, you know, we've basically got the mystery Babylonian schools just founding the country of America through the Freemasons. We know how many of the Declaration signers were all Masons and how all of these people were illuminated. They all had the different, mystery backgrounds like that. So just to kind of look at it in a different overview, it's not really specifically pointing out, you know, this guy individually did it, even though we could go through and find some Freemasons that are involved with this case. Like, I've got some names here you guys are probably familiar with who are Freemasons, who are 33rd degree Masons. My notes are terrible.
So how about Lyndon Johnson for starters?
Yeah. Yeah.
He was a Mason.
That's one of them. And, jeez, I don't know how much it has to do with JFK, but Harry Truman was a 33rd president and a 33rd degree Mason. So
yeah, quite a few of the presidents were actually Masons.
Actually, when you get into the 13 and the 33 and all that stuff, you know, you got the UN logo has 33. There was a pope that was killed after a 33 AD run. The Apollo 13 blew up at 1:13, which is 13:13 military time, on April 13th. The Space Shuttle Challenger was a double number. It was the 88th flight. The U.S. went bankrupt on 03-03-33. It just kind of seems like one thing after another. It is just the same Masonic numbers, the same footprints. Don't even get me started on stuff like the Great Seal. We've got the 13 leaves, 13 berries, 13 letters, 13 arrows, just tons and tons and tons of stuff. Numerically, you've got, you know, people like the Bilderberg Group is 39 seat members that are actually running the steering committee of the Bilderberg. Well, 13 times 3 is 39. We've got the United States itself, July 4th, 1776 to July 4th, 1945, that's 169 years, or 13 times 13. Then, 33 days after that, this one you guys are going to laugh, 33 days after that, August 6th, we dropped a nuclear bomb or an atomic bomb and did that whole, you know, ball of wax. You've got the Cuban Missile Crisis. I believe that was 13 days long. It's just one thing after another.
It never ends.
It doesn't.
And they put it in the news today, to this very day. Any false flag, fake news story are loaded with these numbers that you're calling out. So, all right, Don.
Yeah, what year did Dealey Plaza open again? What year was that built? I want to say, was it 1903?
I don't have the answer to that, but I know that it was dedicated to a Freemason by the name of Dealey.
Yeah, wasn't it George Dealey?
You can look him up.
Yeah, let's.
He's amazing.
You know, we got it stuck in here. Let's. Yeah, you know, I think I came across some of this stuff, you know, a few years ago, but I hadn't done much with it. You know, since then, let's. I'm sure our friends at Wikipedia will. We even got Dallas Parks here. Here we go. Dealey Plaza,
Like I was saying earlier, I didn't really have a full hour presentation.
No, it was okay.
And that's
it was,
about all the slides I got, but definitely some insight from you guys and some stuff like that. I've got maybe a quote or two I've got from a few different books, or we can move into anything you guys want.
I just want to throw this in there. Okay, so Dealey Plaza, you know, this is from Wikipedia, is a Dallas city park built on land donated by early Dallas philanthropist and businesswoman Sarah Horton Cockrell. It was completed in 1940 as part of the WPA, the Works Project Administration. It was one of those projects on the west edge downtown Dallas, where three streets converge: Main, Elm, and Commerce. That's the triple underpass. To pass under a railroad bridge. Yep. The plaza's named for George Bannerman Dealey. He lived from 1859 to 1946. Civic leader and early publisher of the Dallas Morning News.
Ooh.
Who had campaigned for the area's revitalization. Monuments outlining the plaza honor previous prominent Dallas residents and predate President John F. Kennedy's visit by many years. The actual monument honoring Kennedy in the form of a centopath is one block away. So, I thought I had heard something about they were doing stuff at that end of the town was in the early 1900s, but I think the plaza itself, was completed in 1940.
Yeah. All right, so Chance, you were saying that the Masons had been infiltrated, and I actually spoke to someone who was a master Mason today, and he reiterated that.
Now, when they're talking about master Mason, is he trying to say that he was 33rd top degree? Because I'm just looking up master Mason, it's not too far off the bottom here. It's low down the rank.
Right, that's what I was saying. I have one fellow that said he was a 32. And this guy said he was a master Mason and has never seen any impropriety whatsoever.
No, that's exactly what I was saying at the beginning. Let me pull this back up, and I'll get the slide back up on screen. I just got you guys on there for a second. Okay, so on this, like I was saying at the beginning, your first degree to your 32nd degree. Notice how they're basically all up this side in a chronological order. They're all just kind of, you know, you can bump your way through. The Master Mason is this one right here, which is the third degree.
That's kind of at the bottom?
Yeah, basically your porch Masons, that's what I like to call them, your porch Masons, are the guys who are not even really making it in the door. You've got your three basic steps of the Masons. Your first three steps at the bottom, and then your next blocking is this all the way up to the 32nd degree of Freemasonry. Then, the people who, like I said, the only people that are contributing to the great work being ushering in a new world order, a one world government, a totalitarian socialist government running the entire place. That's the only people who make it into this upper echelon 33rd degree Freemason. And there's actually
my friends at the bottom.
Yeah, your friend who's the master Mason, what he's being told, he probably doesn't even know that there's 30 more degrees above him. He probably has been told, you know, you got your first, second, and third, you're master Mason. And that's what he is.
He knows about the 32nd degree. He also told me that he's going to be leaving $500,000 to the Masons when he dies.
It does take money, and that is one of the things that moves you up the ranks, but you can't buy the 33rd degree, and that is why the people who are 32nd degree are like, you know, I've been through all of this. I've seen the Masons from the bottom to the top. There's nothing chicanery going around here. We're a bunch of well-meaning guys in the community. It's basically a boys' club. They hang out. You all know guys, like I know local town guys who are great guys in town here who all meet there at the Masons Hall, but they're not 33rd degree Masons. They're not contributing adepts to the Masonic goal of helping bring in this new world order, this one world government. So that is why you can kind of talk to all these Masons and get their books and get their stuff, and they don't even really have a clue of what they're in. They're compartmentalized. They don't know.
Yeah, most of those guys are like on the Flintstones, like the Water Buffalo Lodge.
Yeah, they're the Royal Order of Water Buffaloes. You can look in here. It's got
Raccoon Lodge.
Yeah, I'm going to read it off my book because it's a lot easier for me to read than the slides. But some of the top ones at the top here, we've got the Royal Order of the Jesters. We've got the Shriners, which actually is this one here in the very middle. It looks like they're using the upside-down representation of the Islamic half moon. That's the Shriners.
Yeah, that's also the emblem of the New Orleans Police Department.
Nice. They've got the Grand Cross, Court of Honor, Active 33, Honorary 33s, Knights Commanders of the Court of Honor. We've got Daughters of the Nile, Order of the Knights Templar. You've got some of these I can't even read. They are so small. It's just amazing when you actually see how many different variations there are in different stuff. Here's one at the bottom, the Order of Jerusalem. The one with the satanic cult star over it is the Order of the Eastern Star. So, I mean, you can get into this for quite a bit just trying to go through the different steps and the different all that. I got one quote I just wanted to read out of here. And you guys are going to see how quality my reading skills are. But this is from Manly P. Hall, which is probably one of the most famous Freemasons outside of Albert Pike and all that. And this is one of his famous quotes. I was able to dig it out. Freemasonry is a fraternity within a fraternity. A fraternity within a fraternity. The outer organization concealing the inner brotherhood of the elect. It is necessary to establish the existence of the two separate yet independent orders, the one that is visible and the other that is invisible. The visible society is a splendid camaraderie of free and accepted men enjoyed to devote themselves to ethnic, educational, fraternity, and patriotic humanitarian concerns. The invisible society is a secret, most august fraternity whose members are dedicated to the service of a mysterious acronym acridundum, or a secret sect. So, basically, like I was saying, there is the good, well-meaning dupes who have no idea what they're doing, and then there's those, those guys.
Yeah, I think Newt Gingrich was 33 degree, so it's people like that.
Yeah, here's a blurb out of the protocols, as long as right on the heels of what Chance was talking about there. So from Protocol 4, Paragraph 2, who and what is in a position to overthrow an invisible force? And this is precisely what our force is. Genteel masonry blindly serves as a screen for us and our objects. But the plan of action of our force, even in its abiding place, remains for the whole people an unknown mystery. Except for our guy Chance, who has unraveled the mystery.
I got the internet, you know.
Yeah.
It's right there for you. Everybody can do this. Couple of books, start reading.
Well, that's it. You know, it's not like you don't – okay, I sift through a lot of stuff, but, you know, this stuff is out there. It's just maybe we assemble the pieces a bit differently than maybe some other people do, you know.
Well, all right. Well, Larry, what are you making of all this stuff?
Well, it reminds me of the layout of Washington, D.C. You know, a lot of people have pointed out, not only the monuments, but how that pentagram, you know, is radiates, you know, from the center of the city. And a lot of the landmarks, you know, and monuments have been designed to, you know, to illustrate a lot of these symbols, you know. So and the first presidents like Washington, Jefferson, you know, all those guys were Freemasons, you know. And so it's sort of like ingrained, you know, in the history of the country, you know, right from the beginning.
Now, like you're saying about Washington, D.C. with the street plan, how it makes, like, pentagrams and stuff like that, the one of the stars in the pentagram is on the Mason Hall.
Yeah.
The big poobah's house.
I also wanted to mention, because you were talking about the obelisk, you know, there in Dealey Plaza, but nobody mentioned the one monument right there that's seen right there in the Algin 6 photograph, which is right there on Elm Street, and is it's part of what actually blocks the part of the view of the front of the Texas School Book Depository building, and is where you see the woman and child and the Federer hat man images to the left of the doorway. And that monument, actually, when we went there last year to check out that area, when you look out the entrance, that monument is right there down the street on Elm, and you have to sort of move a little to the left in order to see down Elm Street, you know, and that was very interesting to note that the exact position of that monument there, and it's also in that same type of design. So, yeah, that was also interesting.
Dr. Fetzer, what do you think of all this?
Well, I think it's pretty damn fascinating. I think being on the 33rd latitude is fascinating. I think everything that Chance presented about the arrangement of Dealey Plaza was fascinating. I think this is a whole different dimension. And that Lyndon, was he a 33rd degree Mason? No doubt. He wouldn't be in it and not be at the top. I think this just is another dimension of the background that represents further sponsors of the assassination, along with the CIA, the Joint Chiefs, the Mafia, the anti-Castro Cubans, the Eastern establishment surrounding the Fed, the Texas oilmen, and Israel. I mean, you know, when you want to ask who wanted JFK out and Lyndon in, you might as well ask who did it.
Yeah. That's a fact.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I think, you know, one point on the anti-Castro Cubans, that's how Mike Piper got involved in all of this, actually. He came across, he was reading somebody else's book on something else, and I forget now, I should go look that up. But one of the anti-Castro Cubans had mentioned to somebody, you know, he was talking, hey, you know, what's up with you guys? You're not doing anything or whatever. And he's like, hey, after, you know, next month, after the Jews take care of Kennedy, we're going to have new backers.
Yeah, that was Homer Echeverria.
Okay, yeah, yeah. And so the anti-Castro Cubans were really doing nothing until they got backing from the Jews.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the people with money.
Yep.
So when JFK was giving this speech, was he just talking about the Masons? Are the Masons the Illuminati? Or is it a bunch of different societies? What are we looking at?
I think when you guys watch the video and you see when he gets to that one part, he starts talking about, you know, it's more than one just group. It's the military, it's intelligence and all that. What you'll see is him actually overlaying six different symbols. Like it was, you know, the military industrial complex. It's the United Nations. It's all the different blocks that are going against us, the CIAs, the intelligence, all that. So, I mean, I don't think he's talking about, you know, it's the Freemasons. He's talking about it's this whole Babylonian mystery schools that have woven their way through thousands of years of history. Look up Jim Mars's book on secret societies. It's probably one of the best that you could track book and go through. This guy goes right through every one of the secret societies back to like recorded history. And like I said, it's multi-generational thousand-year plans that are coming about, and no one's getting in their way. So, I mean, if you want to be president.
All right, the Times-Picayune newspaper that was so hard on Jim Garrison, come to find out with a little research that the Times-Picayune has been run by a Skull and Bones Yale graduate since 1836. Does that have anything to do with this Mason mix?
Yeah, that's them. The Masons are the Skull and Bones. They're in this entire fraternity. All the different guys coming out of Skull and Bones are like the Bushes, the Harrymans, all of them.
Here's an interesting quote that I found on American Masonry, and I'm just going to read this real quick. American Masonry essentially was a controlling factor in all facets of American life, from organized crime to politics. That membership includes politicians and the mob alike, all striving for mutual benefit and protection. Any threat to the system would be disposed of accordingly by the component members equipped to do so. Who do you think killed John F. Kennedy? We did. Do you know why? Because he was a Catholic, and his administration was imposing policy contrary to the interests of our brotherhood. Witnesses were disposed of accordingly through the resources of the agencies involved. There you go.
Yeah, and yeah, here's
and
a quote from
Edgar Hoover, Clyde Tolson, Gerald Ford, Earl Warren were all Masons. Okay.
So was Dulles.
Wow. Yep. Yeah. And here's a quote from a couple of weeks ago. Freemasonry is a Jewish establishment whose history, grades, official appointments, passwords, and explanations are Jewish from beginning to end. So Masonry is basically, it's Judaism for the Gentiles.
That's a good one.
That's, you know, and I've been doing some more research on, I started looking, you know, I keep coming across Jews, so I figure, well, I don't know much about Judaism, so I've started to study it. And one thing I came across, a couple of weeks ago is that basically Islam is an offshoot of Judaism. Apparently Muhammad's,
it's pretty funny when you look at, you know, you've got your three main religions, Judaism, Islam, and Christianity. Buddhism. They're all basically the exact same story being told. It's almost like, you know, this god's plagiarized that god's story. They all have the same stuff like that. But did anyone catch the Vatican's kind of WikiLeaks of their own? It's called VatiLeaks. Did anyone see the story that was coming out with that?
No, tell us about that.
In 2012, I did a whole show on why the Pope was resigning, and part of why the Pope was quitting was one of the documents that came out of the Vatican was this old book, like an old style Bible, where in the Bible it's referencing, they're talking about the second coming of Christ will come around and the Comforter will be there. Now they name it the Comforter in the King James Version of the Bible. Well, in this Bible that was taken out of the Vatican's vault, it actually had the name of the guy in it. And the guy's name, instead of the Comforter, it said Muhammad. So you're basically joining the Christian and the Islam right there, where they're saying it's just like this episode from South Park where their super best friends are going to be Jesus, the Muhammad, and all the different religions all joining together, which is actually what the Vatican is trying to do right now, is create a one world religion. They're trying to destroy the entire church itself. They're bringing about this new world order. And we're seeing it from the Vatican with the religion sign. We're seeing the Masons and all the people on the political side coming around with the United Nations, the framework for the global government. And it's just one step after another, just leading up to this end game goal that we all know is coming.
From the protocols, we shall destroy God. This is the reason why it is indispensable for us to undermine all faith, to tear out of the mind of the Goyim the very principle of Godhead and the Spirit, and to put in its place arithmetical calculations and material needs.
Don, I did an interview with Michael Hoffman, who's one of the leading experts on Judaism, and particularly Talmudic Judaism.
Yeah, he's
and he was pointing out that the rabbis lecture God. The rabbis tell God what to think. It's simply stunning stuff when you get into it. If you haven't watched that interview, we had to do a couple of tweaks to the second hour, but Chance should have it up before long. You want to check that out because this guy really knows his stuff.
Oh, Hoffman's excellent. Yeah. Oh, I didn't know you did a show with him. Yeah, I will definitely check that one out.
That was our last show.
Wow. All right, gentlemen, any last words since our time's just about up?
Thanks to Chance for a terrific presentation. Very, very interesting.
Yeah,
I learned a lot.
Yeah, I didn't know Dallas was on the 33rd parallel like that.
They're on the 33rd everything.
The only last word I would say is it's been more than a pleasure doing the background work for you gentlemen. Being able to come on and contribute anything was pretty kick-ass, and I'm just glad to be a part of the team.
You're terrific.
All right.
Yeah, couldn't do it without you. All right, this has been the new JFK Show number 80 with Chance George, the man who makes it happen in front and behind the scenes. We'll see you next week.